Welcome to the Wisdom Talks podcast, where we share in-depth conversations with thought leaders and wisdom holders in the fields of consciousness, business, meditation, education, and sports. Intrepid pioneers and explorers, pushing the boundaries of human performance, self-awareness, and higher states of consciousness. Changing the paradigm and context of human capacities and capabilities. All are sharing their journey and insights right here on the Wisdom Talks podcast.
The idea that the breath can be your object of focus and stand in for both your inner Atman and the divine, you know, is really pervasive. And you see it in our Bible. You know, God breathes into Adam to make him alive. So when I take all my worshipful feelings and I pour them into the prana as it comes in and goes out. And I whisper sweet nothings, the prana, by using a mantra, you know? And it's also this interpenetrating energy. So it's very erotic, if you will, in the sense, because you're taking it in and giving it back.
Our guest today is Mary Riley Nichols. And Mark and I are delighted to have her. She has an incredible background and history. She has a degree in anthropology from Harvard. She's the director and member of the faculty of Nalanda Institute for Contemplative Science, which studies yoga, mind, and spirit. She's been teaching yoga for over 30 years. She teaches non-dual philosophies of Vedanta, Kashmir Shaivism, and Kundalini Yoga, which is something we're going to explore in quite detail. She also teaches workshops, weekly classes, corporate and teacher trainings. She teaches at the Life in Motion Yoga Studio in New York City. She teaches stress management in psychiatric settings like the Bronxville Psychiatric Wellness Group. She's been involved in ongoing research on mind-body benefits of yoga and meditation. Her focus is very much breath and presence. And again, we will speak to her more in detail about that. She draws on various traditions with well-known teachers like Deepak Chopra, also Thich Nhat Hanh. She quotes from the scriptures. There's one that stands out for me. And it's this: life gives you plenty of time to do what you want to do if you stay in the present moment. That's from Deepak Chopra. So today, we have a great opportunity to explore and hear from someone whose life has been about yoga and meditation and the highest teachings from East and West.
Her story is unusual in many ways, but importantly, she began her remarkable and often dramatic journey as a very normal young college freshman when the latent Kundalini energy awoke, quite spontaneously, while she was studying in her dorm room. She had no interest in spirituality at the time and describes her normalcy in her writings about her awakening on her website. Here's what she said. I first met Shiva one evening in my dorm room during my freshman year at college. It was a few weeks into the first fall semester at Harvard. I had scored a single room as a freshman by claiming on my roommate questionnaire that I was impossible to live with, had erratic sleep habits, and smoked minimally 2 packs a day, which was all true. There was a handful of people I knew in those days who meditated, but the whole thing held no appeal for me. I thought it looked pointlessly unproductive and boring. The intensity of her study and depth of her experience is very insightful and instructive, particularly for those who will never meet a true Shaktipat guru in the physical form. She's adamant about the fact that you can still have a very rich and satisfying relationship with the Supreme Guru who resides in your heart as the essence of your breath. In our conversation, she elaborates on the details of how she engages this divine relationship.
Mary, welcome. So, where do we begin? I'm thinking, when we spoke to you in our briefing a few weeks ago, you spoke about just giving us an introduction to your life and your story, and particularly your spiritual journey. But I was taken by the way that your spiritual journey intersected with your, well, one, your academic journey. And you spoke of your spontaneous awakening.
Yes.
I believe.
Yeah.
Maybe we start there.
I'm happy to.
And just, you can weave into that, if you will, just, you know, bits of your life. But I think the way your life and your early journey, and then your, you know, you're going to Harvard to study anthropology, and
yes,
then this awakening that seemed to come out of nowhere.
That's right. Out of the blue. Shall I start?
Yes, please.
Well, I did go to college to study anthropology. I was very excited about that topic. And one of the things that I studied a lot of was human evolution. And we called it, we sort of nicknamed that department monkeys. And we were studying, you know, all sorts of primate behavior. And I was really fascinated with evolutionary biology. But the thing that really caught me, excuse me, is the cultural anthropology aspect of religion, and especially I got into ecstatic religion. And I was writing a thesis about ecstatic religion and how when societies are breaking down, when their institutions are failing, and they're usually failing because there's some sort of large change, habitat change, encounter with another culture, and the old paradigms are no longer serving. And when that happens, you see this the burgeoning of new, a lot of prophetic and ecstatic, visionary behavior, if you will. And that, I was saying, that seems that this is a developing new belief systems to cope with the new reality kind of idea. So as I was writing that thesis, it occurred to me that, Western civilization, as I thought about it, you know, modern Western civilization is breaking down. And I thought to myself very, very randomly, we must be due for as I thought of it, a spiritual transformation. So the moment I had that thought, I'm sitting at my desk and there's this explosion, very powerful, at the base of the spine, and this energy which went up my spine, wiggled up my spine, and then I was dissolved into white light. And the light spoke to me, and I'm going to tell you really what it said. Usually I edit it a little bit, but I will say what the light said.
Wonderful.
And thank you. It said, God is in a body in your lifetime and you will recognize him.
It literally said those words.
Yes.
What year was this, by the way?
That was 1976. And it was the following, so that was in, I think, the fall of 76. And in the summer of 76, I did meet Muktananda. But between that event, which was so powerful, I jumped up out of my chair and I started looking at my chair like it was guilty of, you know, doing that to me. I ran out and told my roommate. I was like, what the heck just happened, you know?
What was the reaction of your roommate?
She just thought, you know, she rolled her eyes and thought maybe I'd been smoking a joint or something. I don't know.
Of course.
You know, but that was the first. In fact, Larry, it's interesting you asked that, because as I began to share my experiences, which I'm going to tell you a little more, it was my first encounter with the fact that people were going to either roll their eyes, think I'm crazy, or it was such cognitive dissonance that they would dismiss what I just said.
And that was one of the reasons I wondered about that, because it is, especially back in the 70s, unless you were involved in that kind of lifestyle. And I don't know that so many people were involved in that at Harvard Anthropology School, but, you know, who knows? then that's what you would expect.
Yeah. And there were, I had friends who meditated, and I just thought it was really stupid. And I thought it was like, how could that be spiritual? Because I had gone to Catholic school, and for me, you know, spiritual meant you suffered terribly and, you know, you were a martyr and that was spiritual. I didn't know. But I certainly didn't think, I just thought meditation was boring, you know?
So I don't mean to, sorry to interrupt, but I'm just, when you say that, and maybe you could just tell us a little bit about your religious, spiritual upbringing, if there was any, just to contextualize what you're saying now.
Thanks for asking. You're the psychologist, and I know you how you are. So,
yes, he is.
Yes, yes. I can't help myself.
Well, I was raised in Manhattan, New York City, and my parents were very modern atheists, you know, civil rights kind of liberal people. And but the down the street was the Catholic school, and they were both had been raised Catholic. I'm Irish Catholic on both sides, so I went to the Catholic school. Well, the actual childhood had a lot of those negative experiences that they talk about now, these negative childhood experiences. So I was under tremendous stress as a child. And the thing, the stories I could tell you, oh God, but I, you know, they're just things that happen. I don't know if you want to talk about them here, but let me,
You feel is relevant, we will talk about.
Well, I'm as a kid, this is just one layer of what was happening. We were living in a townhouse. My father, he overspent, and we lived in a townhouse and we had a beach house, and he lost it all to loan sharks. Okay. And it was a complete catastrophe, and the furniture thrown out and on the street and all that stuff, you know? Mm. And there was some, you know, loan sharks they're illegal and they behave badly, and it's just a whole thing. So that kind of stress. And of course, the parents were under tremendous stress. So I, unlike anybody else in the family, became extremely religious as a child. And maybe as I, if you will, later on with doing sadhana with Muktananda, I came to know my past lives. And so I have a lot of religious background. And so this really came out as a child. And so I prayed a lot and ran to church and was just really into it. So that's the background. But then all of that I forgot by the time I was a teenager. And, you know, the fascination with ecstatic religion, I mean, by then I didn't really think about God or believe so much in God. I was, you know, looking at evolution. And so I wasn't religious at the time that I started having these experiences.
Your religious inclination had turned almost academic.
Yeah. So I have this crazy thing that happens with the powerful explosion. And I tried to sort of ignore it and push it aside. But then after that, and this is between that, and there was also another experience that I had written about called The Glance of Shiva, where I left my body. That happened in freshman year. But then every so often, I would have these out-of-body experiences, and they would often be corroborating that some really big thing was going to happen for me spiritually. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. So I am usually like I'll be contemplating, doing my homework. By the way, I loved my topic. I wasn't the kind of student that had to do her homework. I just loved it. I mean, I was hungry for it, you know? It was so exciting. So I'm sitting on my bed. I loved college so much. You get your room of your own, you know? So it's so much fun. And I become paralyzed. This would happen. I can't move. And the next thing you know, I'm in another place. And while I'm in the other place, I'm not questioning, how did I get here? Okay, I'm just somewhere else, and it seems perfectly real. So this is one example. So I'm sitting contemplating, I don't know what, doing my homework, and suddenly I'm now standing at the window of my mother's apartment looking out at the Hudson River. She had this great big beautiful view of the Hudson, which is west. It's on the west side of Manhattan. And I'm looking out there and I hear rolling thunder. And when I would have sort of out of body things happen and really, really powerful visions, a lot of times it would start with this kettle drum or rolling thunder, which was like, you know, really kind of frightening. Anyway, so I hear that, right? And I'm looking at the Hudson. It's real. It's not like I'm dreaming. And when you have these visions, you don't feel like you're dreaming. You feel it's hyper real. And so it's very, very much real. And I'm looking at the Hudson and the sun starts to rise, and it doesn't usually rise in the west. But not only is it rising, it's rising the size of the whole horizon. And I am terrified. I think something very strange has happened, that this is the end of the world. And as it comes up, the sun is rising over the river in the west. I mean, it's insanity. And then I'm back.
And then you're just back to where you were. And what do you make of those kinds of experiences? You know, once, so in it, at a certain point, there's a level of anxiety or fear or bewilderment or like, this doesn't fit reality that I know. Oof. And then you're back in your body. Yeah. And what do you make of that?
Well, what I would do is I would sort of go into denial. And I did that. It was sort of similar to any kind of traumatic experience, like awful things I saw as a kid or whatever. Like, I would just pretend that didn't happen. I would definitely push it
away.
That
was your way of dealing with it.
Yeah. However, after a few of these, I did go to the health services, and I went three times. And then the final time they gave me, they tested me for epilepsy because I was describing these things. But the thing is, though, Larry and Mark, you remember the symbolism of the Siddha Yoga logo was a huge sun rising over a river. Oh,
that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
Those kinds of things. Yeah. That's just one of many, many weird things that
and
happened.
And that was before, however, if I can insert, you had any involvement with Muktananda or Siddha Yoga or anything. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I had no idea about any of that.
Now, we know these days more and more that many people have profound experiences. They have no way of understanding them. I mean, it's one of the reasons that we wanted to do these kinds of podcasts. And they, you know, they can't tell people about them, or if they do, they get a similar reaction that you got, which is one of disbelief, eyes rolling, go to the health clinic, so on and so forth. And yet the experiences are more prevalent than you would think. And so many people, when in the calm of maybe an interview, you talk about the inner life and you say, have you ever had such and such kind of experience? Mm-hmm. An incredible high number of people report that, yes, they have. And, you know, when they ask a question like I asked you, so what did you do about it? The answer is, it's not the same, but it's similar in the sense that, well, I just didn't know what to do with it. And I ignored it, and I didn't talk about it, and I thought people would think I was crazy, and so on and so forth, which is not the case. And as we go through and talk more about it, you'll understand that. And hopefully our listeners, who may be some of those people who've had such experiences, start to realize, okay, there are these kinds of experiences, and they happen, as we're saying here, sometimes spontaneously.
Right. That's what happened. And I started, I was having more of those things go on. And then I, surprisingly, in June of 1976, my uncle, who had his own very strange journey to meeting Muktananda, I mean, he had his own strange things that happened that caused him to meet Baba, and then he brought me to South Fallsburg in New York in June, and it was, you know, I Actually, I was talking to the guy who was coming with us, whose name was Arne Weinstein. He was a playwright. And we were driving up to meet this guru. And I don't think they used the term guru. I wouldn't have understood that. And I didn't understand what guru meant in the day. But anyway, we're driving up there and I'm telling him about these weird things that are happening to me. But I have no idea that it's at all relevant to where I'm going. And so the first thing that happened was we get to the ashram just in time for darshan.
Darshan is...
Do you want to tell them?
Well, basically, it's similar to many traditions that we have in the West, where you go up and you meet the person who is teaching, who is speaking. You have an opportunity to actually have a face-to-face with them. In the East, darshan means literally having a vision, the experience of the presence of a great being. So that's a very important part of the program. So rather than just sitting there and listening to a lecture, there's a time where you come up and you actually interact with Swami Muktananda. And in his case, he had an interesting tradition where he would, as we say, bop people with peacock feathers. So rather than shake the hands of 100 or 1,000 people, he would just, you know, give his blessings to each person. And people may have questions. They could ask their questions. They could interact in whatever way was appropriate for them at that point in time.
Right. That's true. So I see this line. I'm a follower. You know, I'll do whatever I'm told. I don't have any real problems with that. So people are on a line. I go on the line. And, you know, there was for some reason I remember so well, it was said that it's traditional to offer a gift, and they were selling fruit. And for 25 cents, I bought an orange, and I get on this line with this guy, Arne Weinstein. And when we get up there and we do this pranam, and I have no problem with that. Everybody's bowing. I'm going to bow too, right? And, I look up at, well, first I looked at Muktananda's face, and he looked like he had, like, all of a sudden, like 100 different faces, like the facets of a diamond, kind of. It was like they were moving everywhere, and I couldn't understand what I was looking at. And I looked down, I was scared, and I looked up again and laughed, and he laughed at the same time. Now I'm really scared. And Baba, so then Arne starts telling Muktananda, this girl has had many visions. And I whip my head around and look at Arne like he's crazy. Like, what are you telling this man about that for? And then Baba bopped me 6 times. I remember it so well. You know, the peacock feathers, they were soft, but they had substance, you know, and they brushed you in a beautiful way, and they smelled good. There was nothing like those feathers. And of course, it was transmitting energy. I didn't know that then, but I go back to my seat, right? And I'm looking at this weird guy that just hit me with feathers. And I was thinking about, or I was remembering, because one of my weird experiences had been, I'd heard this sound, this all-pervasive sound, which I later realized was Om, right? And so Muktananda starts talking about meditating on Om, and he points to me in the whole group. There must have been 1,000 people in the hall, and he points right to me and says, "That's what you're doing now."
Oh my goodness!
And I made a big show. I know. I pretended I had no idea what he was
Turning
talking about.
I was looking around. Like, he must be pointing at someone else.
Exactly. And then I go home, right? And I bought the book Play of Consciousness, and the light was coming out of that book when I got home. And there's just more and more happened from then on. And I couldn't do anything but go back to Muktananda and know he was the one that was being foretold to me.
I see. So that was the connection that you made when the voice spoke to you.
Yeah.
Okay,
oh, yeah.
I understand. And it's interesting because these things are happening. There's little or no explanation to go along with it. And again, we're in this realm of what I call that spiritual awakening, that spontaneous, and you don't know. you just are having experiences and you're trying to piece together what is the meaning of all of this and who is this person and what significance does it have in my life and does it connect to anything that I can understand? And I mean, look, you're a, you know, you're studying anthropology, you're studying different cultures, you know, you made a connection back in your dorm room. It said at these times in history and bang, this all begins for you, which by the way, really connects to your earlier life, if I understand it correctly, but you had forgotten all of that.
So
there is something inside of you. In a sense, that's connecting it.
That
your conscious mind isn't necessarily making those connections.
Absolutely.
So where does all of this, you know, where did it lead you? What happened next?
Well, I then, you know, have the book Play of Consciousness. Oh God, the next few days were very strange. I don't know, you know, how it was for you, but like I'm having very strong spiritual expansion and all this. I had a boyfriend at the time and, you know, he didn't understand.
What does strong spiritual expansion mean? Pardon me for interjecting there.
Ooh,
I knew you
Mark.
Were about ready, Larry.
All right.
Yeah. That's why we have this tag team.
Please indulge us, Mary. We really want to be indulged.
Okay.
People will really appreciate it and very much love it. Yes.
Okay. So the next thing that happened was I was supposed to go for a weekend to the beach with my boyfriend, and I did do that, and I'm not really telling him everything. And I haven't put together that what just happened with Muktananda is the sort of fulfillment of all these weird visions I'd been having. That took me some time. So I just go with my boyfriend to the beach. And at night, we're standing on the beach. And I start to get like thrills of ecstasy. I don't know how else to put it, through my body. And I shoot up into the sky, it would seem. I mean, I'm looking down at the beach. It seems like from a mile above the beach, and I'm looking down and I see us standing there, and then I come back. You know what I think of it? You know what those, they're called Chinese yo-yos, and they're like these spiraling things that spiral out and then they snap back. That's the feeling. And so, because it does, you do come back after you go out there. So I came back and like my boyfriend was totally freaked out because he saw light shooting up out of my head.
He actually saw light shooting out of your head.
He did. And he did not appreciate it.
He did not appreciate it.
I was going to ask, what kind of acid were you guys on?
We were not, and he never took any of that. You know, I had had a couple of, well, maybe three or four when I was a teenager of LSD type stuff, and it was scary. It was frightening, and I didn't do a lot of it, and it wasn't religious for me. So by this time, I'm now 21, so I haven't done that for a long time. So it doesn't feel like LSD at all to me.
It's a different kind of experience that you're talking about.
I feel that it is. I really do. It's been so long since I took LSD, but as I said, I was a young teenager being, you know, unsupervised in New York City, you know, and I'm like 13 or 14 and doing things. But it wasn't for those. I'm not a big fan of the current love affair with psychedelics, partly because I've known a few people who weren't able to hold on to, you know, at least a cogent, sane presentation, you know. And that's been really important for me because of my tendency with this mysticism to stay grounded, you know. it's been really important for me to maintain, an interface with the world, which is recognizably sane.
Yes, it sounds to me like you didn't need anything else to help you along the way.
Not at all.
Even your boyfriend is seeing light shoot out of your head. I mean, that's fascinating that your experience was so strong that it's visible, I mean, palpable to others.
I also tapped him on the chest around that time, and he started hearing Om, and he couldn't stop it. And I couldn't hear it, but he was like, can't you hear it? Oh, my God, what's that sound? You know, and I'm like, oh, my God. But that was, you know what it is? The proximity to Muktananda is like, you know, you're being next to the sun. The power was so frightening to me, really. I mean, he frightened me. But yet he was so kind, and he's been so good to me, you know. But wow, the power. I'm talking about
Baba. He was frightening on the one hand, and at the same time, he was so kind and warm in some way, it sounds like, that your fear stood in juxtaposition to the other emotion that you were feeling about him.
Yeah, he's been like, first of all, my actual interactions with Baba, like verbal and like face-to-face stuff, I could count it on both hands, I think. After being in his ashrams for 5 years, that was plenty for me. But just in terms of his presence within my heart, you know, he never quits. He never leaves you. He's always there. And you know, when you want something that's not good for you, he helps prevent it. That's been my experience. And he helps you realize your desires that are beneficial. I mean, you know, I can't go, I would go on and on if I could, about this great being and his love.
I would just want to interject something that it's a reflection that what I've heard from other interviewees that have had a very similar experience that you've had, Mary. And, you know, I'll refer to, for example, I'm just finishing up with the editing of Jim Carson's podcast, which will be episode number 6. And, you know, he had a very similar experience, and that fear aspect. What I believe and what I've heard, kind of the common thread throughout, is just this the immense power. And yet there's two sides of that, which is this beautiful love that's flowing from his vibrational field. So you've got those two things interplaying, and depending on where we are as the receivers in that whole dynamic, it's kind of which one you're getting the most of, you know?
Yes. You knew he was benevolent no matter how he might behave, that whatever he did was for your good, you know, when you watched interactions with people. And it was so strange, too. I always felt that you did not know what was really going on in an interaction with Muktananda. You know, he might seem to be complimenting someone, and that would be actually, you know, a real correction that he might be doing, or he might be... Like one time he yelled at me, and it was one of my most memorable cosmic consciousness experiences that I ever had. And he yelled at me. And then people were like acting like he was mad at me. And little did they know, you know?
The word that comes to me just in my mind with that fear aspect is awe.
Yes. Very good word.
That there's a quality of awe. And in our daily life, we think of fear, because awe is not something that we experience a lot. I mean, young people and people use the word awesome, but I don't know that the average person really experiences awe a lot.
Right. That's so true. The that sense of awe is humbling. And what I know, and this is true for both you and Mark, there's a humility around the people who knew him because of that. You know, you people, even sometimes they'll say, oh, you're so humble, you know, about me. And I'm like, you're damn right I'm humble, you know.
I've been humbled.
This being, you know.
Yes. It's more like that, yeah.
Have you not?
Yes. I don't think any of us, I'm hesitant to say this, but I don't think my experience is that not many of us really consider ourselves humble, but all of us have been humbled.
I know.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think on a large level, you are describing the experience of meeting, and there's probably more cases of people meeting up with sages and saints and what have you in the East, because it's a living tradition there, that could describe the Ramakrishnas, the Shankaracharyas, you could go on and list from many different traditions, not even just in the Hindu tradition, but, you know, in the Sufi tradition, and we go on and on.
Yes.
And these are the kinds of words and descriptions that you would hear. People talk about Ananda Mai Ma, they go on and on, you know, and it's very difficult, one, to describe, because words tend to fail us, but the experience is so real and so true that it's hard for people to grasp. And to me, one of the values in hearing conversations, hearing you talk about this, is that people start hopefully to get a sense of, one, a deeper part of themselves that can be touched, that can be, as it were, awakened in whatever way, in whatever context, and that it is a beautiful, awesome thing, if we can use those words. And it leads us onto a path.
Yes.
You know, it leads us onto a path. And so what comes up for me is, where did that all of that lead you? Going into the next phase of your life, I guess.
Yes. So I meet Muktananda in the summer of 76. I graduate college in 77. And all that time, that year, I was having a lot of kriyas of the awakened kundalini. And, you know, I roared like a lion. I mean, you know, you can read about this in Baba's books. I'm, you know, having these physical things go on. But at the end of the, when I graduated, I then went to India to spend 6 months there and be with in the ashram in Ganeshpuri. And my uncle had given me that, but I was living on, I think, $1 a day. You know, it was like $30 a month or something to live there.
Wasn't it, Larry?
Yes. Yeah,
totally.
Yes, basic living, that's for sure.
And I remember you, Larry, there very, very well. So we loved you guys, but it was very intense living in the ashram then. And I came home and I tried to reintegrate, be with the boyfriend that I'd had and, you know, get a job. Nothing worked. And I ended up living as a resident in the ashram and then being asked to be on staff.
Was it in New York City?
Yes, New York City and South Fallsburg.
Okay.
So all told, I was 5 years, and I had actually tried to leave, and like other people were leaving, and Baba didn't give me his blessing to leave. He said, instead, everybody else was, this was about 2 years into it. I said, now I'm going out and like, got to get a life, you know? And everybody's getting like blessings to this. Baba was finishing one of his world tours, and he was leaving South Fallsburg, and everybody's getting blessings to go out and live in the world, as we called it. And I go up and I make the announcement, Baba, I'm going to go out and live in the world. And Baba turns his face away and then he says, when are you coming back? And I'm like, what? and he then just said, go. Well, I really can't tell you all that happened that when I tried to live in the world, but I know you guys know when the Shakti's not behind it, how ridiculous getting fired three times from like the lowest level jobs you can imagine, you know, not being able to live anywhere. I was practically homeless, the boyfriend not happening. You know, finally, oh, this would happen. I'm like living in my grandmother's storage room, right?
Oh.
It's supposed to have, I was supposed to have a great apartment. All these things fell through. And this is about 3 or 4 months into having left living in the ashram. And I'm crying in the storage room, right? I'm going, Baba, Baba, help me, you know? And those tears are on my face. My grandmother's phone rings. I pick it up. And it's Nandini Weitzman, the manager of the Manhattan Ashram. I don't even know how she knows my grandmother's phone number, right? I'm still, the tears are still on my face.
Yes, God bless her.
She did. God bless her. God bless her. Yeah. And so she says, Sita, we want you to live and be on staff in the ashram. I swear the tears were not dry on my face. And I start looking around the room like, where's the microphone? I mean, I had just cried out to Baba to help me.
And then you get a phone call. Ring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So I lived for another, I guess it was 2.5 years or so in the ashram. And I wanted to, I was thinking about our talk today and I had very strong evidence of the awakened Shakti, but I wanted to share that I think why that was because Baba, you know, he taught us see God in each other. And when I would do that act, the bhav or the feeling of seeing people as equals, and Baba always said respect, he really emphasized respect, even more than love, he would use the word. And when I would do that, the Shakti would flow. Now, there were people, you probably agree, that who were even quote unquote close to Baba, but they didn't see the people around them as the divine. And, you know, they could be there 20 years and they're still not doing it. But for me, when I would give myself disciple's grace and see God and do the act of seeing Baba in the eyes of the other people around me, the Shakti just would flow, you know?
So you're talking about now really following the teachings of the guru.
Yeah.
Not just reveling in a momentary experience, a spiritual experience, no matter how powerful, that in some sense, it's all about really living the teachings of the guru. And as you do that, you find, you connect to that Shakti inside. Mm-hmm. And that's I think that's, for me, I think that's a really, really important aspect of what the true guru is about. The teachings and the guru are actually not separate. And so when you follow the teachings, you experience that internal guru within yourself. And if you don't, no matter how close you are physically to the guru, as you're saying, Mary, it just doesn't work. You know, you just don't have that because you're not attuned to. Mark was talking about that entrainment, that attunement to the inner energy that the guru manifests and embodies, that it's really within all of us. And then he's trying to get us to attune ourselves to that as well.
Right. And it wasn't about, although people mistook it, even smart people, like PhD type of people, they would think that I am worshiping this guru and you should get out of my way while I can get closer. You know how people were around Baba? They wanted to get closer to him and they'd like push you out of the way. By the way, you just pushed God out of the way, you fool, you know? and once you got that, and you know, I feel the Shakti rewards us when we do that teaching. And I swear it took me a while, like that whole teaching, love yourself, revere yourself, God dwells within you as you. I didn't know what that meant. And I started to let the breath act as the self and I started to love the breath and that worked for me. But, you know, it's like you feel grace flow when you do the gesture that the guru is asking you to do of see God in each other. And I always teach hatha yoga as what you're doing is with your physical body. Those are physical gestures to support a mental and emotional gesture of equality consciousness.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So that's where that breath thing started to come in for you.
Yeah.
Because I can see, you know, breath and presence, was something that and something that you focus on now.
I contemplated the idea of God dwells within you as you for about 20 years before I finally got it, to be completely honest with you. And when I got it, it was a game changer, of course. And I would like to continue to dwell on this for just a minute, because I think it's a real important piece, and it's really part of the thread that we've kind of developed here naturally. You know, the teachings and how the teachings and the what we call the Shakti, you know, and being in the flow of the Shakti / the teachings, and how that resonates with the self and helps you understand and realize what Baba meant when he said, God dwells within you as you. It's you, you know. Who are you? It's you.
Yes.
So anyway, I just want to hear a little bit more, if we can unpack that just a little bit. I think it's really important, particularly now, because we're talking about when Baba was alive, but all of us are living and all of our students are living in no Baba. In other words, there's no physical form. So one of my experiences, key kind of inflection points in my sadhana and the development of my spirituality, was the time from when Baba took Mahasamadhi, he left his body, to, you know, what's next, which was the transition from the physical form to the formless or the subtle form. And of course, you know, we've been developing that. We've had so much more time in that development than we did in his actual physical presence. And all of the people that we are working with, that so we're teaching and that we're sharing with now, are in that mode as well. They will never meet the physical form, but they can very much meet the subtle form and have all of the same experiences that we have and that we are sharing here. So if you would speak to that a little bit, Mary, I appreciate your any of your thoughts on that. That was beautiful. I know you do a lot of teaching too, so you have a lot of students, and I think this is important for the whole world.
Yeah. One of the things just off the top that I'm thinking of now is, and I've listened to a couple of your other podcasts and talking about loving spiritual biographies and autobiographies to read them.
Yes, very much.
And Baba always said, you know, keep the company of the saints. And when you read their lives, when you have their pictures, when you read their teachings, you're keeping the company of the saints. They really have no trouble at all coming through their writings. It's all about your attitude and, you know, your love and your longing. So the longing, it just, I keep company with the saints, and they're really like fun, and you don't have to be a perfect person. That's another thing that I've found. I can relax about myself. I'm not a perfectionist anyway, but you don't have to be, you know, what you think of as a paragon of virtue. They don't care. Do you? It's crazy. I have this idea that, you know, one of the names of Shiva is Ashutosh, which means easily pleased.
Beautiful, beautiful.
It's really fun, you know. I mean, and it says in the Bhagavad Gita, you can give me like some water in your hand or a leaf, you know, I'll take it. I mean, it just, let's have a relationship, you know. And so I feel people don't feel that you have to be, even like I love Anandamayi Ma, and she's so pure. But she doesn't mind that I'm the way I am, you know? She likes having a relationship. It's beautiful. And I really recommend everyone feel, that's one of my thrusts of what I'm trying to convey, if I say I'm a teacher, but is that it's easy. You don't have to be special or different or better in any way at all. God is just so easy to love and to love you back. I really want people to know it's an open season, man. You can just have this relationship with, and just be the way you are, the terrible person that you are, you know? That's been my experience. But anyway.
I think that's very good. The whole thing is about relationship. It's just about relationship. Yes. Build the relationship from wherever you are and let it go wherever it goes, but build the relationship intensively.
Yes. And so when you say God dwells within you as you, I'm always like, me? What do you mean, me? I'm terrible. You don't even know what I'm like. But apparently, you know, I mean, that's one way to take God dwells within you as you, not as like some special aspect of you, but just who you are. And that it's that you have to accept yourself and be humble enough to love yourself. Because I found that loving myself, you know, takes great humility. But you know, so that's one of the things of God dwells in you, within you as you. And I don't know if, Mark, I've had the realization that you might have had after 20 years. Sometimes I just, do hit on the realization that it's the inner self, which is looking out of my eyes. But I definitely work with the relational dynamic for my sadhana on a day-to-day basis. In other words, I'm the devotee and the divine is my beloved. And I use the breath as our connection. And I send messages of love through the breath to cosmic divine love, that I love. So that's what I do. And then sometimes I'm really experiencing that Shivoham, you know, I am Shiva. But I don't really expect much from myself that way.
Well, Larry, I'd like to ask her if you feel we're in a position here. I'd like to just a little bit more indulgence on the practice that you've just described, Mary. I'd like to kind of drill into that a little bit because a lot of
things.
Yeah. Okay, good. Because a lot of people are really interested. The feedback, we're just getting started on all, but, you know, I've gotten some interesting feedback. One of the pieces of feedback was, you know, the practices, they really are interested more. They hear what's going on and that yet they're trying to, most people are trying to, you know, they've heard this stuff for the first time and they're trying to get their arms around like, well, what do I do, you know, every day?
Yes.
So I think just a very sort of, you know, let us know what you do. Maybe not now, but yes, now, of course, we'll get to that. But how you started and kind of how that has developed, I think it'd be very, very instructional and beneficial.
Oh, so I do want to talk about what I'm doing now because I think it's going to be helpful. But, when I was living in the ashram, as you recall, we chanted a lot. If you did all the chants, you know, there were some required and there were some that were optional, but if you did them all, it'd be like 6 hours a day. And I did them all because they just got me, I mean, very high. I mean, it was just really ecstasy. And I liked that, but I wasn't that interested in breath awareness at the time. And so I lived in the ashram. And then when I left, and I did leave because I felt that I wanted to get married and have children. And the way I was living in the ashram, that wasn't part of it. You know, you were really just monastic. And I loved that. So I leave the ashram and I became employed I do everything for way too long, but almost 10 years. I worked in the treatment of stuttering using a breathing technique. And this breathing technique is called the airflow technique. And effectively, you just breathe and let the exhalation go a little bit, and then you start slowly. And when you do that, you're doing something to your nervous system that eases you out of the stutter. And what I did was I helped people with this breathing technique systematically desensitize themselves in their stress situations, which was a great learning about how fear causes the thing you fear because it causes you to go into fight or flight. So anyway, from that, I'm beginning to get some sense of the breath being really a great centering device. And then when I began more to teach, I started to, like I said, when Baba said, love yourself, I didn't know what the heck to do. So I started loving my breath. And it turns out that the word Atman, which is the word for self in Sanskrit, is actually was originally the word for breath in early Proto-Indo-European. It was Atman. So the idea that the breath can be your object of focus and stand in for both your inner Atman and the divine, you know, is really pervasive. And you see it in our Bible. You know, God breathes into Adam to make him alive. So when I take all my worshipful feelings and I pour them into the prana as it comes in and goes out. And I whisper sweet nothings, the prana, by using a mantra, you know? So and it's also this interpenetrating energy. So it's very erotic, if you will, in the sense, because you're taking it in and giving it back. And it's like, you know, it's just really fun. And then we're taught, and you probably were there. I certainly was in the hall when Baba gave the teaching on Hamsa, the mantra Hamsa.
Yes, we were both there.
Oh, I was there too.
All three of us.
Yes. Do you remember we were all astonished because he had been promoting Om Namah Shivaya, and we were all Om Namah Shivaya. We, in our ashram, we did japa. We repeated the mantra and I still do, and I want your listeners, japa, repeat a mantra when you breathe, when you walk. Always repeat the mantra. As Baba said, if it's Om Namah Shivaya is a great world, you know, it's like a staff, you know, that you can walk in the world with. Hamsa is a little more subtle, right? And he gave his teaching in his book, I Am That, that we all were witness to. We were all freaking out in the ashram, like, what do you mean? We thought it was Om Namah Shivaya. Now he's giving us a new mantra. And I don't know, I thought it was crazy. But it took me like years before I really enjoyed it the way I am now. And it means I am that, and it is existence consciousness is I am, you know? And, oh, I have this, I mean, the prana, which is the breath, is it's the delivery system for your consciousness. And you can, you know, breathe it in fully, and you become fully conscious. And there's an aphorism in the Shiva Sutra that says, the link of prana and consciousness is natural. So you know, the awareness sort of mounts on the breath and it goes inside, and then you take it out into the cosmos, you know, on your exhale. And in Tibetan Buddhism, there's something called the wind horse. And I realized the breath is the wind horse. It's like you're flying carpet, you know? And what you must do is worship it. Act like it's God. And we were talking about awe. Without awe and worship and veneration, I don't know how to do this stuff. I mean, other people do. They, you know, they get into nothing is special. And, you know, that's a different path or something. But I use love.
Beautiful. Very nice. And thank you for sharing that. And thank you for teaching us. That was just brilliant. I mean, just, you know, and like Mark is saying, people are, they hear and they think, well, wonderful, but how do I do that? How do I get into that space? Yeah. How do I practice? How do I? And that's just, that's terrific, Mary, because it's really giving people a sense of, okay, this is what you can actually do. You know, this is a practice.
Yes.
And it's a practice that leads us closer and closer to our own inner self, really.
Yeah.
One of the things that you mentioned, Mary, was this emotion that the feeling, what we of course know in Sanskrit is bhavana, that you bring to the practice. This is really interesting and very germane and current. There's a really well-known teacher right now. You might know him, Joe Dispenza.
No.
Yeah, well, if you don't, then I highly recommend that you get his latest book, which is called Becoming Supernatural.
Mm.
It's quite good. He's a chiropractor. His name is Joe Dispenza.
Okay.
But anyway, what he discovered, again, he's working with a lot of our teachings and our tradition, but not using some of the words and not using our Sanskrit words and stuff like that.
Yes.
But very much uncovering a lot of the nuances of the practices. Mm. He's working with the chakras very, very directly and with Kundalini very, very directly, but never using the words.
Wow.
Very interesting. But one of the things that he discovered, which is germane to what you've just said, is that the feeling, you have to bring the feeling to the practice.
Yes.
That is the major inflection point. That yes. is the point of departure.
Yes.
And I just wanted to emphasize that because it was very beautiful what you've just shared. We really appreciate what you've just shared. And the key point, you just kind of said it, but I want to emphasize
yes.
that it's this feeling that you're bringing. Kabir says it's the intensity that you bring to it. He says, I'm a slave yes. to intensity.
Yeah.
So I just want to kind of emphasize that.
Absolutely. And I love that you say this guy is working with the same principles, but not using the same language. I was just teaching today, and I'll tell you what I was teaching because you might find it interesting, about bhavana. And this young man said, I did that. And he never learned about it. He didn't, read about it from a great being. He just figured it out. So there are orientations that to reality that are feelings, which are like attitudes. And, that's what I was saying with when I was living in the ashram. I kind of got the knack of doing what Baba said to do, see God in each other. That means, Baba is, or the guru is this figure, but you have to see that everywhere. You have to learn how to open your mind, to that. And it is about working with your bhav or your bhavana, as you call it, and your feelings to sort of reverse engineer the non-dual awareness, the feeling of being one with all things. I always say it's easy to feel I'm one with nature when you're looking at the ocean, but when you're sitting across from somebody on the subway who's being obnoxious, it's people that it's hard to be one with, That's where it's difficult, where the illusion of separation is most easy to get lost in, I was talking today about a thing in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra, which is, he says, wish well those who are fortunate. And that's actually a maneuver of your will chakra to when somebody has what you think looks like a really great situation, to be happy for them. I think the Buddhists call it sympathetic joy. But that, again, it reverse engineers. If you're one with the universe, then when somebody's got some good deal going, you're happy for them because that's you. And so I had worked with some artists, when they do their auditions, to, strangely enough, even though part of you wants the other people to fail miserably and you to be the successful one. But actually, if you can do the maneuver within your will to wish well, even for just a moment, like a mustard seed of somebody who, I know that you guys, being around Baba, the Shakti takes the envy out of you, but you got to get rid of envy. Envy's the just complete useless. So it's a reversing of the envy feeling. So instead you wish well a person who has great things, if you think they're great. This opens you up. And in my work with people, when they do auditions with that feeling, they get the part. Because there's so much energy with there's so much glowing light coming out.
So you actually find, and people report, that when they do that practice with that strong feeling, it has a physical, outer-worldly manifestation. It produces a result.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, what Mark and I are kind of getting to as well, is when you do these practices, they're not just things that you do wrote, you know, I'll just mm-hmm. do that, say this, blah, 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 without any feeling, yeah. you know, like, and that's, again, yeah. the part that I like about Joe Dispenza's work, that he talks about the power of feeling, that without feeling, wow. nothing yeah. gets transformed. It just all remains the same, and we get stuck and we get depressed and we have all of these difficulties. He said, if we shift yes. our feelings, then things yeah. start to shift in the outer world. And without going into all the detail of it, it's like, you know, what they're noticing in quantum physics now, that when we look at our interaction with things and we have a feeling about that, it changes yeah. things. And because everything is interrelated, in fact, reality. Yes, so that's yes. all about the energy yeah. in the universe. So even on that physical level, we know these things now, science is proving them to be true and to be so. And what he's done, Joe Dispenza, that is to say, okay, mm-hmm. if that's true from a scientific point of view, why don't we use that in our life and our relationships and the way that we interact with yes. the world? But we've got to do it. Yeah. You know, it's like that saying from, you spoke about actors and everything. I think that's a saying in acting. It's like, okay, now once more with feeling. So yeah. it's about that, isn't it? It's like, okay, that's once right. more with feeling.
Exactly. That's so true. And, you know, in when you think of it that way too, like our suffering, you know, the really bad stuff that we all have. And one thing that's happened since I teach yoga privately, so I get to teach, like I have a couple of billionaires that I teach, they're suffering. Anybody needs to know this, they're suffering like we are. Everybody's suffering.
Say that one and more time with feeling. No, I, because this is a space of truth. Yeah. I mean, right. I don't work with billionaires, but I work with some fairly wealthy yeah. people in the corporate world and what have yes. you. And the teachings and the coaching that I do, it's really based on these same principles. You know, I may not yes. talk, well, I don't. But mm-hmm. in many ways, the teachings about leading people and leading organizations, it's really about what mm-hmm. you do with and within your own self. And they resonate yeah. to that. You know, they resonate Definitely. To the truth of it. You don't have to, you know, even talk about gurus and Shakti and this and, mm-hmm. but when they start to go inside of themselves and to look for yeah. what's really true and yeah. how they're going to interact with people, I mean, the truth of what's going on in this universe and in their lives, if you stay mm-hmm. with it, they realize there's truth in that, that you do have to be authentic and genuine and yes. real yeah. and without using the word, have some sort of bhav, some sort of genuineness yeah. in your feeling and in yeah. your interaction with people. So when you say that about billionaires, you yeah. know, it's that's another humbling thing and surprising for people, because many times yeah. what we're looking for is just give me that billion and I'll be fine.
Yeah. Exactly. And I was saying, because I have two wonderful sons, and one is a very ambitious, hard driving, you know, on his way up the hierarchy, does solar energy. And it's so stressful. I explained to him, success is stressful. All those things you want, it's stressful. You have to center yourself. You have to have a technique. Otherwise, you'll be crushed by it. It's very hard to be the head of a corporation or even close to it. You've got so much responsibility. And it's, so I think that the idea of suffering, though, is that it causes you to want, you know, relief, and you can pour that passion of your suffering into your practice, you know, call for the divine, you know, to come into you, with all that pain that you're having. You know, that's so it's using our pain when we meditate. We're lost in space here, you know, and we're all gonna die. So there's not a single person that's not agonizing, really.
And they have to have a way to deal with that.
Yes. Yes.
It's finding the truth within ourselves at yeah. some level, so that we can continue to move forward in our lives. And have a feeling yes. of something really more powerful than the external thing. And it's not about being critical of or devaluing the things in the external world, but it is about recognizing that there is more to it than that. And whether it's anybody, an executive, a billionaire, a householder, or father, mother, son, daughter, it is in each one of those cases finding that place within us of the stillness, of the breath, and then leading our lives from that. It's not about giving up our lives, but it's about leading our lives from that place. And I think that's one of the things that is important to communicate to people, that it's, you know, the spiritual life, the meditative life, the yogic life, ultimately, it's not about a giving up of the world. It is about how we live in the world more than anything.
Exactly. I think it makes living in the world doable. I've been teaching on the theme of joy, and I feel that joy is an unconditional thing. It's not, oh, I got the part, or things are going well with my kids, or joy is free of those conditions. And so you can touch your inner joy. And from there, you know, it's like you're connected to something that allows you to deal with the ups and downs. There's going to be ups and downs, as you know, I'm sure.
Exactly.
You know.
Always, always.
But
So it.
What I see, Mark. I'm sorry, go ahead. Well, the way I look at it and my sort of approach, you could say philosophical, but it's way more than that. My life approach is one of engagement. And, you know, the one, and I'm sure you can both relate to this, of course, is this is what makes it all work for me, is that this is all just Shiva. There's nothing that is separate from Shiva. That's my that's my mental state, but also my experience. And once you embrace that, then everything we've said just kind of all kind of smooths out real easy. Yeah. As soon as you start to differentiate and think there's something else out there, you're off track and you start feeling the dissipation of the Shakti at that moment.
Yeah. I think those of us who, when our Shakti is awake, it tells you when you're thinking in ways that are counter to the enlightenment state. It just, you know how it is. You know, if you argue, I don't like to argue. I don't like to get angry at politics. Those things I feel the Shakti doesn't care for it, at least in my life. But then when it likes the way you're thinking and feeling, you get energy.
Yes, exactly.
That's a hard one, I think. And I totally agree with you that with all the best intentions for wanting to improve our lives and this world, we sometimes get caught in negative thinking, critical thinking. So we stop seeing the divine in other people. It's just my way, but one of the things that, I don't know when I came across it, was just the realization that everyone at any point in time is doing the best they can. Okay? Now, that's not to say that it's perfect, they're the best person on the planet, but I don't know, it helps me. If I think that everyone is doing the best they can at any given moment, and that's where they are on their path, and each of us is like that, then it helps me to be able to see the God in them, to feel the God in myself, to connect with them, just to connect with them in a real way, because I'm not thinking, oh, they're trying to do this awful thing. And at some level, you know, at some level, maybe they are. Maybe they are trying to hoodwink me. Maybe they are trying. You know what I'm saying? But it's like saying, but that's where they are. You know, they're feeling like, in order to get over in life, in order to be joyful, happy, fulfilled, I need to do this thing to this person. And that's just what's happening. And I'm like, okay, well, if that's where you are right now, yeah, I get that. You know, you're just trying to find the joy and the happiness and the fulfillment in your life. Yes. You're not really just trying to be a mean person. It's a subtle but powerful emotional bhav, I guess you would call it, you know, that if I feel that within myself,
yes, I would.
It helps me to feel a connection to them, because then I can remember all the times in my life when I do the same thing and, you know, and I have compassion.
Oh, boy.
I have compassion for them because I'm having compassion for myself.
Yes. And there's a like liberating maneuver that you do. And at the same time, we don't stop going to the voting booth, demonstrating, you got to keep doing those things. And, but not with hate, you know, the Shakti just will not support that feeling. I can't do it.
That's a real interesting observation, and I think very appropriate as well. As you continue to evolve in consciousness, you can't find that place of hate anymore.
No.
There isn't any of that. It's just not there. And also, I noticed that you start to become aware. We were talking about at the point where you start moving away and you start feeling the dissipation of the Shakti.
Yeah.
You feel that much, much earlier in the process as you continue to evolve your consciousness. You know, in the early days, it takes a while. You almost kind of get maybe, and you maybe sometimes do need to get a little bump in the head. But as that continues on and your awareness and your consciousness continues to grow and expand, just a nuance and you got it.
Yeah,
you start feeling it and you immediately course correct or whatever.
Yes.
Interesting process.
Yeah.
So why do you do what you do now?
I have this because in a way with, you know, the overwhelming spiritual experiences, the preparation that I had and then being with Muktananda, I feel, that I have this purpose to share. And, you know, I think each of us that new Baba, we all share in our own way with our own constituents. I'm from New York City. The people who understand my language, you know, they're getting it, you know, they're getting it quick and easy, all the stuff that I learned. So I really feel, you probably do too, that we have to sort of give back before we leave our bodies what we received. And I'm worried that there's just not enough time because I'm still learning to appreciate my guru's greatness. Every day it becomes more apparent. I can hardly conceive of it, you know? And I also want to put a shout out to Nityananda, Muktananda's guru, who I feel so close to. And believe me, everybody who's listening, you know, you can have a relationship with Nityananda. And, you know, he has no judgment whatsoever about, you know, anything's bad or whatever. Just do it, man. You will connect with such a great, great Shakti. So loving, so divine. And anyway, so I do this because I feel that I have to, and I teach, and I'm getting a lot more work now because there's a lot of demand for these types of techniques and understandings, as we have a lot of stress. It's a stress management thing, really. But I got to do it to before I leave my body. I'm afraid when I do leave my body, they're going to say, "Hey, we gave you so much, you didn't give it out."
So is that some of the work that you do with the Bronxville Psychiatric Wellness Group?
That's so I will sit with in group therapies for people who have stress disorders, which would mainly panic attacks, which, as you know, have a lot of breath. The symptom is shortness of breath, tends to be. People will often think they're having a heart attack. They're terrified. It's like suppressed fear that comes up, and helping people to manage these panic attacks through breathing, which is comparable to what I was doing with the stuttering, because when you breathe fully in and fully out, you turn on the parasympathetic aspect of the nervous system, which is relaxation, and you can really short circuit the fight or flight reaction and turn it into a mindful moment of calm. And I have to tell you, I am so afraid of public speaking. I mean, insanely frightened and shy, but little by little. And you know, when you teach this, if people are out there who are teachers, get them to breathe as soon as you start, and then you'll all be calm and you kind of reduce your own fight or flight response. By breathing. So that's what I do with them. And I teach like different places. And I do have two hatha yoga classes. And in those, I always try to get people to understand that you're doing this posture to, as body language, to express those bhavs that we're talking about, whether it's courage or stability or balance. And that it's all about helping you to develop the feeling that goes with the body language or the pose.
Okay, so you do teach hatha yoga, physical yoga, as well as the philosophy and gentle meditation and all of that. Yeah.
I'd like to ask you, Mary, if you would maybe dig in a little bit, be a little more granular with what you're sharing with those people that have these anxiety attacks and all relative to your breathing. I think that you're on to something really big there. And I know you know that already, but I'd just like you to share that a little bit with people. I think they would very much appreciate that.
Well, it's pretty simple. It's basically first getting people in touch with their breath so that they can feel it and be aware of it. So sometimes I'll do one of my favorite techniques, and I will say that these happened spontaneously while I was living in the ashram, and I didn't know there was names for them, but there's a pranayama which you do with your pursed lips. You breathe in, and it's called Sitali, which is cooling breath. Let's do it together. So you're gonna exhale, purse your lips, and breathe in like you're sipping the prana. We'll do it together now. We're gonna breathe in. Hold it for just a few moments and let it out through your nostrils. And just feel what happened. We'll do it again, but good. So we're going to do that twice more. And for a little bit of fun, because we're interested in prana, which is the breath of the universe, when you do, I don't like wine, I like gin, but I don't like wine. But if you taste wine,
just
so you know.
It took me a minute to catch that one, Mary. I'm sorry. That's good.
Okay, we're good.
Okay. However,
you're my kind of lady, Mary.
Good. So, but when you do wine taste, my husband does wine tasting, and you know, when he takes the wine in, he puts it over his tongue and he kind of breathes in. So instead of tasting wine, we're tasting prana. Okay. So I want you to do that with me. We're going to breathe in and taste the prana of the universe. What does it taste like? Let's check. We're going to exhale first. Now breathe in. Hold it. And let it through your nostrils out. And just feel what you feel. Beautiful. And let's do one more. And you can really see, once you pay attention, to the physiological effect on the mind of that way of lengthening the breath. Because when we're anxious, we breathe short. And this is in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra also. He says, your breath becomes disrupted when you're anxious. The whole Bhagavad Gita starts with Arjuna going, I can't breathe. I can't do this. And he's in a fight or flight, you know, thing. So we're going to do it again. We're going to taste the prana. We're going to lengthen it. And we're going to appreciate it and hold it in for a moment. So take an exhale. Feel it on the tip of your tongue. It'll cool you emotionally. Okay. When you're agitated, this will cool you. Let's do. And let it out. Immediately changes the state.
Immediately.
Yeah, you move from the sympathetic to the parasympathetic very, very, very quickly.
Right.
And such a simple thing. Such a simple technique.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I'm teaching a group therapy of people who have stress disorders and so on, you can see some people don't want to actually, you can see there's a moment when they, this works, you know, and not everyone wants to transform themselves and actually help themselves. A lot of people actually are kind of committed to having their problem. This is something I've observed, but you can see this works. And for those of people who want to make a change and to develop the tool, it's the beginning of really starting to get control. I liked how you said at some point in this talk we've had that you lead your life, you know?
Right.
With the breath, you can lead your life.
Hmm. Very good.
Yeah. Yeah, the old fear of success syndrome that you...
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very, very common in society today, in our culture. Mm. Yeah.
Taking responsibility, you know, it's like, uh-oh.
Oh, yeah. That's a big one. When you start owning it, oh, my God, it's a game changer. I love it. Yeah.
This is so good because you're talking about... What I love about this is you're talking about people being able to work with breath. I mean, yes. We all have breath, you know, and so to be able to use,
can't get away from
you know,
it.
To use that tool, not just to survive, but it's a bit more than that, isn't it? It's about going to another level of our being by working with our breath. That's just very profound, I think. And I think people think spiritual life, and this is one of my observations, that it's a complicated thing, that it's a thing that we have to take time off from our regular life in order to do.
Yeah.
And this is saying, no, it's just you adjust your normal life. And the breath is like this lever. It's like this universal lever, isn't it? The way you're working with it, Mary.
Oh, I love the way you put that. I've never thought of that. That's great.
Like the universe has given us that.
Yes.
And all we have to do is work with it and use that lever. And as was it Archimedes?
Yeah.
Give me a long enough lever and I can...
Yes. That's so good. Yeah. And then, you know, and Baba's sort of like his highest teaching was worship the Lord of Prana. It was one of the last things he said, but he is that Hamsa. So it went from lots of chanting and everything to the most simple distilled thing, which is the breath. How could it be the answer? But apparently it really can be.
Yeah. That book, I Am That, that's my wife's absolute all-time favorite book. She's a yoga teacher too. And this is like, she said, I don't want to read anything else. This is just like, I just read one or two lines of this and I'm out. I'm in.
Yeah.
She's loves it. So succinct, so clear, so just, it's just the naked truth. It's beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to, you know, sort of drill into one thing that you said very early on in our discussion today in our conversation. You mentioned right at the beginning, before you met Baba, you said, "I didn't really understand who the guru was back in those days." So I'd like to ask you now, after all these years, decades, who is the guru now to you?
Oh, my goodness. I guess the guru is more me than me at this point. You know, there's not, they're just shreds of me left. But so, of course, I have pictures of Muktananda everywhere. I get the experience of Guru Bhav. I don't know if everyone knows what this is, but it's really where you feel you are that. You know, you could feel his face on your face. And I get Guru Bhav with Muktananda or Nityananda, and I always have since the day I met him. So he became, you know, the in-breath and the out-breath is really the guru for me. You know, they say that we read the Guru Gita, and it says in the Sahasrara, in the thousand-petaled lotus, there is the hum sa is vibrating, and the feet of the guru I think of as hum sa, the in-breath and the out-breath. So in a way, I've made the breath my guru, if you will, because, you know, you can start to let your mind relax and you don't have to have rigid categories. So I don't know. One time I was walking through the courtyard and I had to do seva. Baba was on his, this was in India, on the couch there, and he was sitting cross-legged. But as I pranamed, and when I looked up, he had stretched his feet toward me. It was just such a generous moment because he was talking to other people. Nobody noticed it, you know, and the 2 feet was right in front of my face. So the in-breath and the out-breath, hamsa, is the guru. You remember how when we have our mantra card, it says the mantra, the guru, your inner self are all one and God is one. So sometimes it's the mantra. Sometimes it's the breath. Sometimes it's the picture. You know, that's my.
So
that's the only way I can answer
the question.
So all those things
are merging now for you.
Yeah.
Whereas it starts out as a separation, much like in the Christian tradition, the Holy Trinity. You start to realize that they're all the same, really. As your sadhana takes you deeper and deeper. But I don't know why. I just love that first comment you made about it when Mark asked you, the guru is more me than me, or something like that, you said, you know, and then you went on to talk, but it led into this thing of really it's merging. It's all becoming the same. Those things that seem different are now not different. And so in the beginning, and for me, this is important for people to understand, because I think in the beginning we get caught with the differences, and we see the guru as only this external form and being.
Yeah.
And that presents its own challenges, you know, and as we move along, maybe we deepen our understanding a bit, but as we continue to move along, and I think that's the important thing, is to continue the practice, and you've given us some beautiful practices here, that you start to see how you actually start to see and experience how these things that seem separate in the beginning are really one and the same.
Yes.
And then you realize that that's the point of our spirituality and our spiritual practice, to start to see and experience the oneness of things. And that ultimately is the solution to all our problems.
When
you start to feel that and live that, it's like, oh, yes, it's better.
yes. Right. Beautiful. How wonderful to talk to you guys. It's just bliss.
It's our pleasure talking to you, Mary, and what you're sharing.
Definitely.
It's enlightening. It's beautiful. It's, you know, and I love that you're giving these particular practices. You know, wasn't that great, Mark? How she just, yeah. You said, could you get more granular? And she said, okay, try this. And anybody listening, I hope you got it, you know, that you could just practice these things. You know, sometimes when I'm working with athletes, I'll give them practices like this, and it's interesting for them to hear it on one level, but then to actually practice on another level, because that's what makes the difference. It's nice to know these things and understand these things, but it's more than nice when you actually practice.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
One thing I'd like to say relative to the discussion that we had there when I asked you the question about the guru, one of the things that I have found, and I say to people, it's a lot easier, really, to relate to the non-physical guru. You know, again, all the people that we're teaching now and we're working with, most of them have never met someone of the, you know, iconic magnitude of Baba, and probably never will in this lifetime. And they wonder, you know, can I still get it? Well, I can, you know, I like to assure them that absolutely you can get it. And in fact, you already have it. You just need to recognize it and dial into it. So yeah, it's just a lot easier. it's a lot easier. Yeah. I think all of us, having been with Baba, particularly Larry, who spent a great deal of time really close to Baba. You know, it's a lot easier than the formless rather than the form. The form gets real complicated, doesn't it, Larry?
Yeah, there are certain complications there. Yeah.
I have no idea what that was like. That's why I said at the beginning, I had, you know, a handful of interactions, and that was just fine with me. But I could see Baba's love for you, Larry. That was something I noticed, and I even had dreams about it while I was in the ashram. So there was something profound about that relationship. I'm sure you too, Mark. I just didn't see it because I just noticed Larry. But
he was the
I didn't
guy.
Know. Yeah, wasn't it fun? You know, it really was. You know, I just
would you characterize it as fun, Larry?
Oh, good. No, look, I think for the most part, there's a couple of things, and you've already mentioned it. That yes, I experience the awe of being around him, and at times I thought I couldn't. I wouldn't be able to manage that, being that close to all of that energy and what have you. But I think part of what a being of his nature does is they help you to manage it, okay? Because it is a lot, you know. Sometimes you just go in and you're interacting, and it's just like, wow, you know, can I think straight? But over a period of time, I noticed that I was able to just stay on the task, that what you learn, or what I learned, what worked for me was, you know, it's almost like following the guru's teachings. And when you're around him and he's giving you tasks and responsibilities, to focus on those tasks and responsibilities. And then just like you're sharing about what bills or manages the Shakti, that when you focus on the task that he's given you, it does that. It manages the Shakti. It enables you to do the work. It enables you, and in fact, it's almost like sometimes a magic carpet ride, in the sense that, you know, you feel like you've got so much to do. How are you going to do it all? But if you just commit to doing it, to give yourself with as little ego as possible to the task at hand, that divine energy, that Shakti as we call it, just carries you. You know, and you look back and you think sometimes, and I would think, how did I do that? How was I able to kind of manage this and then that? You know, yeah,
so
you're
cool
thinking and inside, it's like, oh my God, you know, all of these things, you know. And so it's interesting to get your perspective, you know, what you saw, because I'm on the inside just dealing with it, and you could see in your own way. But then when you have other people who look at you and you say, you know, Baba has this love and this and this that. Yeah. I mean, I think obviously Baba has, you know, love for everybody. He used to say, I don't love anybody.
Yeah.
But I love everybody. Mm-hmm. Which is something to get your head around, which is just another way of saying, I love the universe, you know, and I love everyone in it with that equal. And so to be around him, all of these little things, not little, but things that we're talking about now, you really have to work on living them, or else it doesn't work. You get burnt to a crisp.
Exactly. And I'd known a few people who stayed in the ashram, and they never kind of got the see God in each other part, you know. And it was kind of weird. It's like, how long are you going to hang around and not do this thing? What was it like for you, Mark? Did Baba interact with you? Because I felt he was affectionate with Larry. I felt his gaze was affectionate. Maybe I didn't see, you know, him interacting with you that much, but I saw it in his gaze, some affection.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you asking, but I'm going to answer just want to unpack a little bit more with Larry. Mm-hmm. Baba was aware. I didn't know this at the time, but this is what I've realized over the years. I really didn't know this at the time. I didn't know what was going on at the time. I was kind of like Larry, you know, we're just trying to survive, basically. Larry didn't say it that way, but I will. If you really want to know the truth, Mary, that's really where we were at. I mean, we were just trying to get to the next day. And, it all looked very different, you know, from the outside.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But on the inside, that's where we were going with it. I mean, Baba was so powerful. And what I want to say about that is that Baba was aware of his power. And let me just, in terms of Larry, he knew that he could just burn him to a crisp. Like he could do to all of us. But he was very cognizant of that. And because he knew how sensitive Larry was and how fragile we all were at that time, and Larry's job was to be right next to him, he was very gracious with him, was my experience. And I know that Larry, because he shared with me in many times, in many ways, you know, he was burning. He was burning much of the time, if not all of the time. But if Larry is, if he's nothing if he's not cool. So,
that's so
you
true.
Know, he was cool, and that's why he was in that position of being the front man, so to speak. I had a very, very personal relationship with Baba, but I was not the front man. And thank God, because I just wasn't schooled in that way, and that just wasn't me. I was raw. And Baba was with me, my experience of Baba was raw. Baba was a real wild man. He was a sadhu of the highest order, and much of my life was a parallel to his life. You know, I was all over the place and did all kinds of really insane stuff, and Baba related to me in that way. You know?
I can totally relate to that, because, you know, I had a really wild and crazy upbringing, and I didn't feel pure at all compared to all these nice girls from their bourgeois homes or whatever. I felt like he and I were like, you know, space cowboys together, even though, like I said, there was a lot of interactions on the material plane, but I mean the Shakti that he was just passing, and I knew he knew what I was going through.
Yeah.
You know? But I love that he had every person had their personal experience of him, and, you know, calibrated to our temperament and character so amazingly. So you were a wild man, and he said, "Yeah, let's go."
Exactly.
Right?
And you know, just the kind of feeling of, you know, how do I deserve this, which we all have shared in numerous ways. I can remember one time, and specifically, I met Baba in 1974, just 3 days after he came to America. And I traveled with him up and down the West Coast. And we used to do 7-day retreats in those days. This was before the intensive was developed.
So
we were at Redwood Glen. It's this beautiful redwood forest place that we were doing a retreat. We did several retreats there. And one of the things that I ended up, I was in charge of Baba's kitchen. I had a pickup truck and I carried his kitchen around because he cooked all of his own meals, of course. And so we'd pull the kitchen in, which was an Airstream trailer. And we'd pull that up next to his, wherever he was staying, in the house he was staying on the retreat site. And so that was my thing. So I was always kind of like around Baba's house. And after he would come back, you know, he would usually eat. And then after the morning program, then he would come and he would lie down for a little while. And he asked me to come in and massage his feet. And I'm thinking to myself, I mean, you know, I had already been to India and all over, and I knew what the guru's feet were all about. And I'm sitting there massaging his feet, thinking to myself, what did I do to deserve this? You know, just thinking like, you know, I'm nothing, you know. I'm holding the guru's feet, you know. And, you know, that was really interesting. And you know, I've reflected on that many, many times over the years. And, you know, just his way of teaching, he met you right exactly where you were at that moment. And that's the power of the guru.
And I know from just reading a little about you, going on your Facebook and stuff, that you're very interested in food. So I love that you were, you know, and the idea that Muktananda was cooking his own food, that he was so dedicated to the purity of the food he ate because of his mission. And you're very interested in that too, still.
Well, you're right. The last words that Baba said to me on the physical plane was, feed people and chant the name. That was the last thing he said to me before I left, before he took Mahasamadhi.
Oh my God.
And that's what I've done my whole life.
Beautiful.
So kind of sums it up right there.
Beautiful. And I just, you know, what he would always say to me is, go explain to those people what this is all about.
Because he knew you knew how to do that.
Talk to those people.
And you know, you do have an amazing voice quality, and I guess it would be your speech inflections and stuff are just extraordinary, but it's also your demeanor that explains it. There was something about the whole package was the explanation.
Well, he saw whatever, and I think that was what we're talking about now is something about the capacity that a true master has, the ability to see deeply into people. And then to give them, to do with them, to work with them in exactly the way that it needs to happen. So it's a combination of both getting in there with you, but also leading you forward. So it's like taking you where you are. So that whole thing that you were saying before, Mary, about not being judgmental, not saying, oh, you have to be perfect now and everything, but just saying, oh, that's where you are? Right, I can do that with you.
Exactly.
This is
almost
fun.
Like, I like doing that with you.
It's like all those faces. I remember that comment you made about when you first saw him, all those faces that you saw in him. I mean, it's, to me, one of the things that the true guru is, he's every man and every woman. And so he has that capacity to relate to everyone. And you see, when you're around him, you get that experience. You know, you really get that experience.
So
I felt that, you know, he saw me. he saw me. You know how they say it these days? What, I don't know what the phrase they use is, but it's something like that. You see me, right? You know, and that's exactly what the true master is. He sees you, and he doesn't. Yes. That
he so yeah, did, he doesn't. He really did. He saw where you were, yes, were insecure, yes,
that's
about
exactly
yourself
right.
too,
and he knows that, and he understands that, and he kind of works from that place. Mm-hmm. To, in my experience, in mine, it's to get you to understand that you're more than that insecurity. You're more than that doubt.
Yeah, you know, he gave me that name, Sita. And when he gave me that name, I had, first of all, I thought everybody in the ashram with their spiritual names, even though I was, you know, really like in reverence to Baba because of all my experiences, but I thought it was so stupid, all the spiritual names, you know? And I just did. But then one day I dreamt that I went up and got one. I said, you know, I'll humble myself and I'll get a spiritual name. So as I'm going on the darshan line, you were talking about burning. So a lot of my fears, anxieties, insecurities start coming up intensely, like magnified beyond. And my biggest feeling was impurity, you know, because I had this wild and crazy life as a young person and had done everything and did crazy stuff. And I just felt I was tainted. And all the girls around the ashram were so pure. And I really was disgusting. So I go up to him. And just as I pranam, I think, you know, I'm so impure. And I'm so tainted. I could never get married, you know, and have children. I'm just beyond that, you know. So I pranam and I can't even look at him. I'm so ashamed of my disgrace, you know. And I feel this, that he's put his hand under my chin to lift it up to look at him, but he's not touching me. But I feel this, and he looks at me, and he looks so deep, and he goes, Sita, you know? And I didn't know who that was or what that was. And people said the wifely purity, the wife of Ram, you know, the divine, perfect wife.
Beautiful. Yeah.
You know? Oh, yeah. But I want to say one more thing too about, like, so our listeners, they don't meet him in the flesh, but read his books and, you know, look at the pictures and get a connection, because, you know, Jesus had great disciples long after he died, disciples who became one with him, like St. Francis of Assisi and other great beings. And so you don't have to be in their physical presence, okay? Just take your longing, connect, and you will get everything.
Mary, I so appreciate you saying that, because that is exactly my feeling. You've just taken the words right out of my mouth. I mean, that's what I recommend to everybody that I meet, is read the books of these masters, their autobiographies, the stories about them. This is keeping company with the saints. And I mean, you've just articulated it so beautifully, and it's absolutely true. Your experience, I mean, all of us, we have the experience that infinite capability is right there if you just access it. Just reach out and it'll be there.
We hope you enjoyed that conversation. We've included all the links to the research institutions and other topics we covered in our conversation in the show notes on our webpage. Also, check out our new Facebook page at Wisdom Talks Podcast. If you're searching on Facebook, it's three words: Wisdom Talks Podcast. Send us a comment, ask a question, or just say hi. Please share the page with your friends and ask them to do the same. Please help us continue the conversation and share the love by sharing the podcast with a friend. It takes just a minute, but creates lots of good karma that is multiplied many times as others are inspired by your sharing. If you've learned something, been inspired, or just want to hear another amazing episode, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast at iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your ratings and reviews help us tremendously by getting more exposure, enabling us to share to an even wider audience. Please check out our sponsors, Hamsa Foundation at meditatenow.net and LarryHolmesPracticalWisdom.com. You can contact us directly at those respective websites, where you'll find all episodes of the Wisdom Talks podcast, show notes, links to where you can listen to all podcasts, and our blogs. Special thanks for the generous support of the following individuals and institutions. Audio assistance from Leo Dale at wefostudios.com. Music courtesy of Shanti Mandir. Santur music by Vinay Desai, accompanied on tabla by Vivek Pandya from their album, Chit Akash, available at shantimandir.com. Thank you for joining us. We hope you'll join us again on the next episode.